Podcast 091, Wafati and Eco-Buildings. Sponsored by my buddies at PantryParadis.com. They sell food preservation tools. Produce, prepare, preserve your own harvest.
All right, it's going. Say hi to the pod people.
Hi.
All right, we're at the Inland Northwest Permaculture Conference in Spokane, Washington. And we're going to talk about Wafati today. So this is, and hopefully this contraption in my hand will actually make the slides work. So we're talking about an eco-building that from the inside will look like a log cabin, but with a lot more light. You won't need to heat it or provide any air conditioning. It should be about three times faster to build than a conventional building. We're going to talk more about eco-buildings like Cobb and Straw Bale and some others and how long it takes to build them, which is longer than a conventional building. And it should cost about five times less. And most of that cost that we're going to have in a Wafati is going to be things like toilets and sinks and showers and stuff like that, because the shell itself is going to be freaky cheap. So, all right, here's the big test. It didn't do anything. What if I push the button in the middle? It doesn't do anything. What if I push the button? Do I point at the computer or at the thing? Or probably, let's see, how about enter? How about, that's not it. Ooh, there's one that says laser. I have a laser.
Put your glasses on.
Yeah, I had to put my glasses on and like sit here and ponder this thing for a while. What if I do this? What? You want to do that? You want to sit over there and hit the next button? Because this thing doesn't work worth a damn.
Does the laser work?
Oh, wait, admit, did you do that? Oh, all right. We're going to control the computer using a biological element and voice control. I'll use the mighty power of the English language to change slides. All right, and I'm going to be one of the most horrible presenters you've ever seen because I'm going to read my slides. Those are up there to remind me what it is I wanted to talk about. All right, when we talk about eco-building, most folks are keen on Cobb or Straw Bale. The primary design change is the exterior wall. So basically it's like, oh, you still have a roof, conventional foundation, but and the walls on the inside, still usually the same, but it's the walls on the outside that we've changed. Now, some Cobb structures are very fascinating in that their walls on the outside or even on the inside might be Cobb, and they could be really creative and awesome and beautiful. Still need the same basic roof, floor, foundation. Art Ludwig has an amazing article that he's written that's out at oasisdesign.net, and he is a brilliant, brilliant, awesome man. Can a 4,000 square foot home be green? And in this, he pontificates that if you make a 4,000 square foot home that's all eco and green, you know, straw bales and whatever else, you know, whatever, your greenest are your greens, that it is actually worse than a 2,000 square foot conventional home built with all the nastiest, gickiest stuff. And a lot of it is, and we're going to go into some of these things, but a lot of it is that those materials are transported thousands and thousands of miles. And all the things that we think of as eco turn out to be totally violated en route to getting that eco-ness to you. So then, you know, part of the goal is like, we'll bash straw bale a little bit, and we'll bash all the eco-buildings. People can present which eco-building they think is going to be superior, and we'll bash that too. And in a loving way, really, I promise. But the article is awesome, and I can't do it justice here in just a couple of minutes. Next slide, please. Straw bale. Cost of labor is higher. And, well, did I get... okay. You can replace some of the costs of labor with doing a workshop. But a lot of people do that. We're going to have a workshop. Come on down. Help us out. But I've heard from a lot of people that do conventional building, and then they go and they build three or four straw bale homes. They say it's like building the exterior shell of the house twice. Now, granted, you can there are styles of straw bale where they're load bearing, and so you don't. But then they have their issues too. Almost everybody ends up doing it where it's non load bearing, where you have basically a structure that holds up the roof, and then you fill in between that structure with straw bales. There are some other ways to do it and stuff, but still, it starts to get kind of complicated. The cost of materials is typically higher. I mean, people are paying like $3 to $6 a bale for straw. Plus that straw, I think it'd be worth checking into, almost all straw that's available for sale, almost all, like 95%, especially in this area, is going to have some copperylid, imidacloprid, picloram, something like that in it. I don't think it's going to be a problem to have it in your house, but I would be a little bit concerned. I mean, I think as we're seeking something that's eco and organic and clean, we don't want something that's going to have a persistent herbicide with a half-life of 11 years living in our walls. Probably not a problem, but I mean, that's a big, I don't know. Could there be a problem? I'd rather not find out. I would just rather not use it. But I've been to places where it's like, oh, look, we built this straw bale house. Well, where did the straw bales come from? 1,000 miles away. Put them on a semi-truck. Now, what's eco about that? It doesn't seem very eco to me. Did it come off of an organic farm? Well, no. So if you're out in the middle of a wheat field, then I think right there could be a very economic place for a straw bale. And plus, you know, I think there's another great question about like, hey, wow, monocrop. Let's support monocrop stuff by getting straw bale, by building a straw bale home. So I can kick it in the nuts some more. I'm going to, I think. Let's see. Straw is not particularly a good insulator. Straw, I mean, I think the R value of straw is like 1.5. I think solid wood has a higher R value than straw. And then it depends on how tightly it's packed. And in order to be able to build a straw bale home, a lot of times they really have to pack it so that way it can stack well. Because if it's kind of loose, better insulation, then your walls get kind of floppy and it doesn't work out real well. So they really want to pack them tight so you have a good solid wall. And that reduces the R value of straw. And then I think another great thing is that Ianto Evans and all the Rocket Mass Heater folks, they make a great case about all of our designs about living in a Ziploc bag. So I don't know about all the building codes, but it seems to me like there got to be this building code where it's like, okay, everybody needs to live in a Ziploc bag. We need to be able to seal the house because our heating style is that of convective heat. We're going to heat the air and then heat the people. So you can't have that air leaking out of the house. Seal it up tight. Seal the house tight. And then they find out that everybody keeps breathing everybody else's bad breath and farts. So then it's like, well, it turns out people are getting sick from that. So what are we going to do? We're going to poke a hole in the fucking wall. We're going to put a hole in the wall, and we're going to not only do that, we're going to require that people build a Ziploc bag house and require them to put a hole in the wall. Just a hole. It's just a hole with little venti things on it. And air passes in and out, but you have a Ziploc bag, and it's required. It's code. I've been to houses where they have all kinds of weird things about having these holes in the wall. It's ridiculous. All right. Next slide, please. Cobb. You can make... Was that a question for you?
Yeah, I was just wondering. So you might be cool with all the building codes and what you're doing. We've run into that so many places. I mean, we didn't even build enough places because of the building codes.
Oh, my. Building codes. Oh, yes, yes. The government loves you so much. They want to get all up in your business. I could probably come up with a 4-hour lecture on thou shalt not innovate, you know, unless you've come to us with millions of dollars. If you don't come and bribe all of us, and there are 47 government agencies who expect to be bribed, then you don't get to do, you don't get to innovate. And this could take, I mean, this is something that the Earthship people went through. They actually got a law passed in whatever state they're in that's something about, like, being able to get a license to innovate. But it's like, before you can discover what you want to try and discover, you have to tell them what you're going to discover ahead of time. You have to have a crystal ball. They're required by law. Get that fucking crystal ball out there. Fire it up. Find out what you're going to innovate. Document it. submit it to them, and they'll tell you if it's a good idea or not, and whether or not you will be allowed to invent that. And they have no idea how trial and error works.
Want to try some stuff, see if it works. If it doesn't work, I'll try something else.
No, that's not okay. No, you're not allowed to do that. So, there are places that have no building codes. There are places that have no building codes. So I'm going to make this presentation for those people. Plus, the other thing is that this is 80% of the designs of a Wafadi are an Ehler structure. And there are stories of people. There's a great story. There's this guy. He's somewhere in Europe. He has like 2 acres of land. He built a 4-bedroom home. And the government shows up with like these 3 people. And they say, "We're here to mess up your shit. Because we hear you have a 4-bedroom home on this 2-acre property, and you never got a permit for it. So we're here to make you sad. Where's the home?" And the guy's working in his garden. He says, "You find it, you show it to me, and then we'll talk." So these 3 people went all over the property. They never found it. On 2 acres, a 4-bedroom home on 2 acres, they didn't find it. So they left. The guy continues to be taxed for bare land. So, I would never say in a recorded podcast, go out and break the law. I would never say that. That would be wrong. That would be wrong. I am saying that I heard people doing it. I've heard stories. I've heard tales. And I can say that there are a lot of places that don't. There are a lot. I mean, but they're rural. I mean, you know. So, and plus another thing is I think we've got all these Occupy things going on and whatnot. And I kind of think whenever I hear of a story of like some government coming down, getting all up in your business and stuff, I kind of think, you know, that department seems like it's overfunded. I mean, think about it. People here 500 years ago lived in teepees. They didn't have, I mean, those teepees were not up to code. Don't we kind of have a right to live that way? Can't we live in a weird little box? I mean, granted, it's like, oh, nobody's going to insure it. Fine, don't. I want to get rid of those guys, too. So you make a really good point. I think that that's a 4-hour thing on its own. Josho.
Just a little out on that. The Universal Building Code allows you to build a 9 feet.
Sometimes they say those sheds are not allowed to, you know, like the height inside of the shed has to be less than 5 feet, which can be awkward. I mean, it depends. I mean, county by county. Sometimes they say it's 100 square feet. Sometimes it's 220 square feet. I mean, there's all kinds of wonkiness about, you know, it changes from county to county. And plus, you know what? I'm into permaculture. I want to get 20 people all living under one roof. And the whole strategy of getting them to not stab each other is a whole different presentation. All right? So now I'm going to move into the bashing Cobb section. And before I start bashing Cobb, what I want to do is I want to say Cobb is so beautiful. If you have the time to build a Cobb structure, I mean, there's just nothing. Yonto Evans has done amazing things in like basically people living in pieces of art. And on top of that, I think that if you were to have a large structure of some kind and then you take your most obnoxious, picky person in the world, say they're 16 years old, and say, okay, you have your choice. You have a standard bedroom that's going to be 12 by 20. It's a massive bedroom, but it's got walls like this stuff, but it's white, like that stuff. Standard wall, common wall. And you've got a 10 by 10 room, but it's been totally decked out by some guy who builds boats. It's got this whole nautical theme going. The walls are wood. There's a bed built in with all bed built-in drawers. It's clearly, it's been like somebody has been doing their art thing throughout this 10 by 10 structure. And say, you can pick whichever one. Standard big thing that's boring or tiny awesomeness. And I'm pretty sure that most of the time, the pickiest of picky teenagers would still go for awesomeness. I think a lot of us, any of us in the room, of course, slam dunk. We'd go for the awesome little room. But I think other people would still go for the awesome little room, too. Other people. All right. Now on to the bashing. Usually you must import a dump truck or two of sand to your land. So, like, you're going to build a whole house out of Cobb. Usually you can go dig up some clay somewhere in your backyard or somewhere down the road. You'll bring it over or something like that. But you need sharp sand to make it, you know, work, and a little bit of straw. But, you know, like you're bringing in a couple of dump truck loads, so suddenly you're importing material. And that can be a big one. Yes, sir? Oh, that might help. Cob is going to be a mixture of sand, clay, and usually a little bit of straw. And you mix it all up, and you get it mixed just right. And then you shape it into whatever you want, and then you step back, and it hardens. And it's actually very nice. I mean, it's like cement and totally not like cement. Very hard, but like if you like people who talk about standing on a cement floor all day and their back goes all wonky and they're going to file workers' comp or whatever, people who stand around all day on cob don't get that feeling, and I can't explain that. But cob's got a lot warmer feel to it. It ends up looking a little bit lumpy because almost every time people work with it, they're doing it by hand. But I've seen some cob structures that are amazingly beautiful. So this guy's saying it's like adobe. Yeah, I'm going to say it's like adobe. So you're taking your cob, you're mashing it into bricks and stacking it up and filling it in between with more cob. Kinda, yeah. I've got some videos on YouTube of a tour of Cobville. That's where Yonto Evans is, and he's done some beautiful, beautiful things with cob. If you have no clay, you'll need to find a lot and import it to your land, so more importing of materials, because basically the walls end up being like a good foot thick in order to be able to hold weight and you know, hold together and stuff like that. So that's a lot of material that you're bringing in. But you got to shape it into anything you want. And it's easy. It requires very little skill. You can go take a weekend workshop down in Cobville, and when you're done with that workshop, you can go and build your own home. I mean, easy. Any shape you want, any kind of wonky thing you can think of, it'll be amazing. Cob is beautiful and easy, extremely labor-intensive. It's going to take some time. If you pay for the labor, the cost of your house could be triple the cost of a conventionally built home. So I know of somebody that built a zero-bedroom home, and they paid for the labor to have the house built. So this is, it had a little loft, a little room. It was a tiny little house, $300,000. So small little thing up in the Seattle area. So, and they just paid for the labor is what the thing is. Next slide, please. Whoa, too fast. Okay, log cabin. This is funny. Nobody needs me to explain a log cabin, right? We all got that one. You can get free materials from the land, but you need lots of logs that are a similar diameter. I mean, have you ever seen a log cabin with big logs and little logs, and they're all different kinds of sizes? So you kind of, for most of the structure, you need all your logs to be about the same diameter, unless you're willing to go out there and kind of hack them into similar diameter, which most people aren't really willing to do. And you've got bigger logs that have street value, so a lot of people are kind of reluctant to use the bigger logs. Lots of labor for each log. Some people want to build the log cabins with green wood. Some people want to build them with dry wood. And when the wood is green, it's like full of water. It takes 12 people to lift one of these logs. So now you're like coming up with ways to try to move these logs around. It can be huge. Letting them dry makes it a lot easier. You still need a conventional roof and foundation in order to pull this off. So now we've again replaced the logs on the outside. Now here's the great thing. Most of the log houses I've ever seen, it's like, oh wow, look at this log house. This is awesome. You live out in a forest. You've got 80 acres of woods. Is this wood like right off of your land? Oh no, we got it from Canada. A huge semi truck came over 1,000 miles. They pre-built it far away, and it's like, you know, aren't there any United States? Oh, yeah, but they want more money. We saved 10 grand getting it from Canada. Next slide, please. Mike Ayler. I know it starts with an O, but he actually pronounces it Ayler. So here we are in the land of hippies. I mean, boy, I've seen a lot of hippies today here at this event. But you know what? I think none of the hippies we've seen today could hold a candle to Mike Ayler. That guy's a hippie. He is a lovely man. And so one winter, He was sitting in his shack, freezing his nubs off. And he had a lot of time on his head. He didn't have television, so he sat there and he worked at the paper, and he was like, okay, I'm going to make me something better. I'm going to come up with a better shelter. There's got to be a better way. So he ran the math in a whole bunch of different ways, and he came up with a completely different design from anything that I've ever heard of or that he had ever heard of. Is totally different. And we're going to look into some of his stuff in a little bit. But he came up with something that was easy for beginners. It was very fast to build. And freaky cheap. I mean, he's living in a little shack. He got his own property. I mean, it's a back-to-the-land kind of thing that he did. He's up in North Idaho, like Bonner's Ferry. So, and I've got some video that I recently took of this. So it's like, I think at the time I took the video, the first structure he built is 37 years old. Still standing. People could move in if they wanted to. Next slide, please. So it's a pole structure. Dominantly a pole structure. Now, a lot of people who have familiarity with pole structures have things in their head about why pole structures suck, and we're going to address that. But a pole structure is basically the idea that you're going to have, rather than having a cement foundation and then you build stuff on top of the cement foundation, instead you take something that's like a big straight log, 20 feet long maybe, and then you're going to sink 3 or 4 feet of it into the ground, right into the soil. And then now you pack it in good and everything, and now you've got like this big, strong stick right there, and you can build anything you want to onto it. It's strong and it's stable. The amazing thing about pole structures is that they are freaky cheap, just crazy cheap. You can build them very, very fast. Now, the problem with a pole structure is that where the wood meets the soil, you've got this lovely mix of soil microbes and oxygen and wood all mixed together, and the funguses love that, the bacteria love that, love, and rot. We're making compost here, right there in that spot, and then next thing you know, 10 years pass, and that big strong stick now flops over. So, we need ways to, if we can mitigate that problem, then we can cut about 60% off the cost of the structure. Because putting a foundation in is very, very expensive. So then there's other things we're going to gain from this. Like, for example, the thick green roof. Rather, I mean, when you think about a green roof, if you want to build a proper green roof, a good green roof is typically 10 times more expensive than a conventional roof. I mean, there's a lot of layers in there, and then they have this roof that's 4 inches thick, and they're handling the drainage and stuff like that. However, Mike came up with a design that said, well, rather than having all the water go underneath all the soil and then it flows down and then I capture that and I route it to my gutters and down and away and keep all of that clean, he said, what if my roof actually came all the way down to the ground and met the soil? Well, then I don't need to worry. There's all these things I don't need to worry about so much. Oh, that must be Bud. So now there's a rhythm to what we're doing. All right. There's a little bit more to it, but if you use this special design that he came up with, it just dramatically wipes out the costs of so many different things. Yeah, maybe we should go ahead and close this door. Maybe it'll buy us 10%. All right. In Ayler's work, yeah, it didn't make any difference. Closing the door. Hey, pod people, can you hear the drums? That's right, wail on those drums. Okay, the first structure he made would cost $50. Now, granted, it was small, but it's still standing, and he stayed in it for years. He lived in it for like 20 years. And when you look at the video, okay, the guy's a hippie, all right, so it looks like hippie habitat. But if you look past you know, a lot of the hippie habitat, you can see the structure itself and how it's designed, and it's like a very solid structure. It's been there for 30 years, and now, of course, there's been thousands of these built, maybe even tens of thousands of these built all over the world, and there's all kinds of people on the forums. We've got all kinds of people talking about how the ones that they've built and how they were holding out and the different kinds of variations that they've come up with for different bits and bobs. And we'll see some pictures of this more in a moment. And then he did an add-on for $500. But then in one of the videos we're talking about, okay, you know, $500 add-on. And he's like, oh, yeah, $300 of that was for the carpet. You know, wanted some carpet. So I think that this is a great place. We would talk about eco-building. So we go like, oh, yeah, I built my brand-new straw house. If you built this house conventionally, it would have been $100,000. But my awesome straw bale house is $300,000. But it's eco. And so I kind of think, I don't know about that. When I think of eco, I think of like those guys that say, look, I built this house for $5,000, and it's like a three-bedroom house. And it's like, now that's eco. They pulled materials out of the waste stream, and they used materials that came right off of their land. To me, that's eco. That's really eco. All right, next slide, please. Mike's book, the title leads people, including me, to think of other lesser designs. And of the lesser, he mentions the lesser designs in his book, that he hates those designs and that they suck, and he bashes them, as he should, in the book, thoroughly and properly. Next slide, please. All right. Here we've got a hillside. Here we've got a slope. And we've got a conventional house sitting on it. I mean, pretty basic stuff. Next slide. Here's Cobb. Can you go back and forth between that a little bit? Ooh, look at that. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Yes, yes, you get the idea. What's changed in the picture? Nothing but the exterior walls. It's possible that you might use a Cobb 4. I mean, those are kind of cool. Those are becoming popular. All right, next slide, please. Straw bale. Okay, do the thing again. Do the snappy, ooh, special effects. Yes, that's right. There's a tip jar on the way out. No, I just, it's not a tip jar. Okay, same thing. I mean, we just made the walls thicker, but with straw. And what makes straw really insulative is just the fact that it's really thick. So, next slide, please. Here's how we deal with water. So I'm going to say that this little thing here, I mean, this is a feature that seems to be missing from a lot of conventional homes and a lot of eco homes. And this feature here is probably the most powerful feature of the longevity of the home. I call it a ditch. You just put this magical ditch around the uphill side of your house, and all that water that was going to like try and test your house to see if it might possibly be a boat, it just takes that whole test scenario out. Then your house can be a house instead of a boat. Why is there water in my basement? You know, it's like, hey, this ditch will fix it. So the water that's coming down here hits the ditch, goes around the house. Water coming off the road hits the ditch, goes around the house. Easy peasy. Next slide, please. Okay, so here's what most people think of as an underground house. I want to point at this and I want to make sure this is labeled clearly. Don't do this. Don't. No, bad. Bad. Bad design, okay? I've heard this from multiple sources. I don't have the exact numbers, but a lot of the anecdotal information I've heard is that 90% of these houses that are built this way are abandoned at this time. 10% of them are still functioning. And they come up, and so if you go to the next slide, then here's another variation on it, and I kind of wonder, where'd all that dirt come from? I mean, does anybody know? Each one of these houses I hear about, it's like, oh, this is the way I want to build my house, and it's kind of like, well, where did you get all that dirt? Did you bring it in to fill it all in like this? Canada. Oh, they brought it in from Canada. Okay, next slide. Here's the adventure. Here's what happens. You get all this rain coming on down the hill. It comes and it finds your don't do this house. And it tries to do the boat test theory. Let's see if we get enough water behind it and push it on down the hill. So what you have is that inside they made this wall here out of cement. And, oh, man, your house just smells like a basement. It feels like a basement. Man, it's like a basement. And it's musty and it's cold. It's miserable. And then they get, like, little puddles of water in here all the time. I mean, I don't know. Do people like that? People are like, ooh, you know what would be awesome inside my house? Puddles of water. That's what I want. So, you know, a little lake feature that's only an inch deep. So people then start putting in French drains right here. It's like, that's not what French drains are designed to do. That's going to help you about 10%. So now your house is going to go from totally sucking to 10% less sucky. So this whole thing really doesn't work out. Next slide, please. Evolve the house. Da-da-da-da. And did you know that, and I remember when I was growing up, a lot of the guys were trappers. And they loved to trap the skunks because if they could trap a skunk and the skunk didn't let go of that skunk stink, they could bottle it and sell it and make big, big money. That was the thing that they really wanted was that skunk stink because they would sell it to the perfume folks. The perfume folks take that skunk stink that we all recognize and don't like. Apparently, if you mix a couple things in with it, the girls think it smells real pretty. I don't really understand that, but there's big money there. So you could take something awful and make it something awesome. So we're going to try and do that. We're going to start with that piece of shit we were looking at earlier. We're going to try and turn it into perfume. Okay? So let's go on to the next slide. All right, so here's don't do this. Next slide. Now what? I added that little thing there. Remember that thing? Kind of wraps around, kind of keeps a lot of water. You'll notice how that thing is like lower than the floor here. That helps keep the puddles out. Yeah, and you'll notice that there's not like a French drain right here that's higher than the puddle place. That's an important feature. So we did that, and then plus all the water that's landing on the roof is going downhill. So now we've eliminated all those water problems, which is like why 90% of those don't do this structures are, am I blocking your view?
No, yes.
But in a good way. Da, 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 da. So it was the water, which is why 90% of those structures were abandoned. So we've mended that. Okay, next slide. All right. Now I'm making triple sure that any water coming down the hill gets moved around. And I've extended this out here to make it so that any water that is coming from above doesn't get too close to the house on the uphill side. I've also made the roof thicker because I like growing things up there. Because I want more insulation, and I'll add some insulation later. I want things here. There's stuff I want from having a much thicker roof. Plus, I dug it out from here. I had a place to get it. Next slide, please. Here, I've added the insulation layer. Now we're getting into this thing about thermal inertia. So John Haight has a book out there called Passive Annual Heat Storage. And in this book, he talks about some houses that he's built that require no heat. And he built them in Missoula, Montana. Kind of cold in there in the wintertime, Missoula. It's a lot like here, maybe a little colder in here. So what we have here is that we've got all this rock in here. And his idea is that John Haight extends this umbrella. An umbrella is one of the phrases used for it. He extends it 20 feet beyond the edge of the structure. Now, with an underground house, one of the things that they say is like, okay, the soil temperature stays at about 54 degrees all year long. And it's kind of like, oh, well, that's great when it's 20 below outside. But you know, when it's 50 outside, 50 in your house kind of sucks. You know, I think 70 would be good. You know, 65 is okay. But, yeah, 50, that bites, man. So, like, what? It gets up to 60, now you're going to open up your windows to bring the heat in? So, this thing, this little, all this simple, simple thing makes it so that you have the capacity to set your own thermal inertia. If you make it big enough, and if you don't make it big enough, then it's helping. But if you make it big enough, it solves everything. But it's your choice and your designs and how much help you want from this. But the big thing is like, okay, let's take a look at what our roof is, especially with an ailer structure. Because this is what we've talked about. This is what basically what this is. Ailer doesn't have this in it. This is a John Haight edition. But what we have here is we have a layer of black plastic, total cost maybe $40, $50, depending on where you get it, and another layer of black plastic. We've got soil, dry soil here, and then another. We've got wood duff or any kind of insulative material you want to use, and then another layer of black plastic. So then the idea is that when the rain comes down, it lands on this first layer of black plastic and runs off. And then your second layer of black plastic can kind of be like an emergency, you know, just in case a leak's propped up or something like that. The $50 house has never had a leak. So you've got your thermal inertia here, and granted this is a thinner layer, but this is a much larger gob of thermal inertia down here. And if we're keeping it very, very dry around the structure, then it's going to work in our favor. We're going to be able to set the temperature in our home, and it'll maintain that for 6 months or more. So John Haight's book talks about, you know, the 20 feet thing. He's determined that to get that 20 foot umbrella, that buys you 6 months. And so that thermal flywheel, if you will last about 6 months. Next slide, please. I added wood. Here's the pole structure element. You can kind of see that. Now, if you use, I mean, there's going to be different kinds of wood. Some woods are better than others. So for some wood, you're going to use like a, if you were to use tamarack, pine, most of your conifers, I mean, you're talking about a 5 to 20 year lifespan for the structure. Ayler used it. He's got 37 years on his and still going. But, you know, there's some concerns and stuff. However, if you use black locust, how many people here have heard of black locust? Oh, wow. Good. Half. So that's kind of wood where the farmers used to call it stone wood. They say that you make a fence post out of black locust, and you go and you stick them in the soil. They'll last a day longer than stone. So, and some of them say you put them in, you know, put your fence post in, and you wait 40 years, and you pull it out and flip it around and use it another 40 years. It's 4% fungicide by weight. It just one, but you know, there's parts of the wood that can rot if you get an older tree. You want to get the younger stuff, and it has that fungicide in it, and it'll last a very, very long time. It'll outlast you. Next slide, please. Oh, and I should say that all of this is available at my website, richsoil.com. I've got a great big long web page that has all these images in it and stuff like that. Look, all these pins suddenly pop up. Like, why the hell am I writing this down then? It's got it on a website. Hell yeah. All right, this is something that is, I've got a few deviations. So most of this is going to be Mike Ayler's work. Some of it's going to be John Haight's work. And then I add some of my own things. And one of the things that I add is that there's going to be an opening to the downhill side on all Wafati home designs. You can make Wafatis that are freezers and basically root cellars, animal shelters, and things of that nature. But for a home, there's always something to the downhill side, which is going to be able to, you know, it's going to have windows and stuff facing down here, so you have more glass. Because here you're kind of looking uphill. Your view is uphill, which actually isn't all that bad. It depends on, of course, what you plant here and what you do with this space. But we're going to take a quick look at a video in a little while showing Ayler's original $50 house. And it doesn't have this downhill thing, but he mentions it. It's a gable roof. This is a gable roof kind of design, and we'll see some better pictures of that in a little while. But let's go ahead and go to the next slide. Here's what happens when it rains. Notice the difference? If you don't, I think if you go to the next slide, it shows you the old pic. Here's don't do this. See where all the water kind of concentrates on the uphill side? So it can kind of, if you got a real good gully washer, you might experience the boat effect. Then and then we'll go back to the picture we were just looking at. And you ain't going to get any boat effect here. Okay, question.
Yeah, how deep is that ditch and what are you putting?
That's a great question. The answer to that question is it depends. Yeah, it really works for damn near everything, doesn't it? I mean, like, how big a house did you make? Did you make a 16-bedroom house? Because a ditch might be a bit bigger for that, you know? But then if it's like a little, I mean, you know, a lot of eco folks concerned about footprint, they might build something that's only 300 square feet. Like Joshua was talking about, like, let's do something really small, like 200 square feet, because we're worried about, you know, people coming and giving us a hassle. Which, by the way, one guy who built an Ehlers structure, he posted these signs around his property that said something like, if you work for the government and you come onto my land, there's a $10,000 a day use fee, and it's for the individual, not for the organization. So, and it's something about, I mean, there's a big long thread about it at Permies, and I don't fully understand it, but he says, if you're going to play this game, it does work, but you got to kind of know what you're doing, and you got to be prepared for some headache. But it sounds like he's gotten it to totally sing for him. The people that are all the people that want to give you grief about, you know, building codes and stuff, won't come onto his land. He's been building whatever he wants. So, what was your question about ditches around the...
Yeah, and what would you put in, gravel or maybe sand?
I think, okay, what should you put in it? Should you put gravel in it? Oh, hell no. Should you put sand in it? Why would you do that? I would say that the thing that I would do is that before starting to build any structure there and I'm shaping out where the structure is going to be, I'm going to have me the biggest track hoe I can buy. And I'm going to put the smallest bucket that will fit on it. And then I'm going to go, like, let's say we're talking about this one here, this little wraparound ditcheroonie here. I'm going to take the head on that bucket, and I'm going to push down so hard the front of the tracks on the track will come up. And then I'll move over a little bit and do it again. And so I'm compressing this so that any water that comes down into that is going to just go right on by. It's not going to go into the ground. It's going to go around. Does that answer your question? So this is kind of how Sepp Holzer builds ponds. But that's a whole nother, that's a two-day thing right there. How does Sepp Holzer build ponds? Yes, sir.
Using those principles, is there a way to modify this if you're building on flat land?
If there is a way to modify this for flat land, I don't know what it is. Ehlers got a bunch of examples of stuff that's built on flat land, and I look at it and I just think, wow, first thought comes along, you're going to be sitting in a swimming pool. You know, so all of my designs that I've done for Wafati is for sloped land. And but, you know, in the world of permaculture, and from a perspective of horticulture, I personally am not a big fan of valley floors. And those are the big frost pockets, right? I'd rather be up on the slope. Hell, the Big Black Book shows us that. When we look at that for permaculture, here's where you build your home, on the slope. Because then you can kind of control, you know, the frost stuff, and you can control a lot of things, including flood stuff. But I'd have to say that these structures, that's going to be, I mean, they are awesome in windstorms. They are awesome in earthquakes. They are awesome in almost every kind of imaginable disaster except floods. You know, they set off a nuclear thing somewhere near you. This is probably your best bet. In fact, Ehlers got a whole DVD all about how to prepare a shelter for, you know, explodey radioactive things and, like, surviving. So, but that's a different, it's got some variations, and I have to admit, I kind of skipped through that DVD a little bit, fast forward, like, man, this is boring. So, what? Oh, question way off in the corner from my bio unit for changing the slides.
What is this right here?
Okay, that's going to be the gable roof going downhill. So we'll see some better pictures of that later. I made this with Microsoft Paint. Can you tell?
Yeah.
I'm an artiste. So, yes.
One, I don't understand why, what the function of the poles, the addition of the poles is, and two, what's the floor made out of?
Well, okay, so the poles and what's the floor made out of? So with the poles, we get a lot of stability. I mean, we get the stuff that's going to be able to add the strength. I mean, you think about it.
It's dug down into the ground, the poles.
Yes, these are like 3 to 4 feet into the ground. So now your pole is like really sturdy, upright, and you can build things onto it. Whereas if you just kind of balance the pole onto the ground, which basically what most houses are is they have a cement foundation, and the pole is kind of balanced on the edge of that foundation, and then they try to like super glue the bottom of the pole to the foundation with bolts and nails and whatever they can come up with, and maybe actual glue. But the thing is that that's not very strong. I mean, that's easy to break up. So then they have to like put up another one over here and then put the cross bracing and come up with strategies to keep them from, because they really want to do this. So then they got to come up with part of their strategy to keep them from doing that. Whereas if you do a pole structure like this, you're good. You start adding anything like that, you're just adding to the integrity of the whole thing. So that's the pole thing. For the floor, that does get to be a questionable spot. And Ayler likes to lay down a layer of plastic and throw carpet on it, which I'm not a big fan of the carpet. But I've been to his place where he's done that, and it's like, it feels nice. It does feel good when you're walking on it, and it's quick and it's cheap. But I think a cob floor would be the thing I would shoot for. Yes, sir? With Haight's work, Haight said that like the first year he had like 67 degrees inside the house on the coldest days outside without any additional heat. On the second year it was 69, and on the third year it was 70. Because you think about it, if it ever should get a little cold inside, but it's warmer outside, what do you do? Like if you're feeling like inside, it's 68, it's a little cold, but it warmed up today, now it's 75 outside, what do? You open a window. So now, and basically it's inertia. So it's gonna basically end up at a point that's gonna be like whatever is your comfort normal, whatever is the thing that you're kind of seeking. So every time that there's an opportunity to open a window and adjust the overall temperature, then you naturally do that. And then after a while, that the inertial wheel is set to something. So then when you get into the summertime and it's like 85 degrees outside, but it's 69 inside, you're probably gonna keep your windows closed. You know, but some people aren't that sharp, so who knows? Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so say you can't get a black wolf's hole.
Right.
What do you use so that it doesn't rot on the bottom?
If you can't get a black locust pole, what do you use so it doesn't rot on the bottom? Cool. So the guy with the signs has his techniques, which are slightly different from Ayler's techniques. Ayler is still doing this weird thing, which I don't agree with. I think it's a bad idea. And that is where he takes like 10 black plastic garbage bags and duct tapes them to the bottom. But I think that any water that's currently in that wood will then just make it rot. I like the idea of when you go to pack the soil around it, you'll mix in a little bit of diatomaceous earth and maybe a little borax. And the idea is you're going to try and keep everything dry all around your structure, so none of that will ever get wet and none of that will ever come into contact with you. So now borax, I mean diatomaceous earth, you eat it. I can give an hour-long presentation on diatomaceous earth, but you're eating. Anytime you eat grain, you're already eating diatomaceous earth. They put it in the grain to help keep the bugs out of it. It's entirely edible. Borax, which comes in many varieties, has a very low toxicity, but it's still toxic. So I would have some concerns about, like, I don't want that to move down into the water table. I don't want to touch it, even though people do things with it where they're touching it all the time. I choose that I don't want to touch it. I don't want to be in a place where it's going to end up in my air, even though a lot of people do that. I mean, they use it as a flea control. They'll spray it all over their carpets and leave it there for weeks to control fleas, and they walk around on it, and the kids are down there licking it. No, as well. But it's a low toxicity. Joshua.
There is like a little bit of a fire, so you just turn it outside, you can charcoal or whatever, but it's still getting there.
they'll build big, big fires, and then they'll, like, put the logs on the fire like hot dogs, and then they'll roll them every 15 minutes so that they get charred all the way around. And now that's not a full solution, because there's still those that rot. But if you keep the logs dry, if you keep the wood dry around it, that really helps. See, the ailer structures tend to let water come right up next to the wood, and I think that's not a good idea. Whereas the design here is to try and keep all the stuff that's in the ground very, very dry. So charring helps. I think I would go so far as to say charring probably adds 35% to the lifespan of the wood. And if you use that same wood and you didn't char it, I think you still get like 1,000 years of life out of it, provided that you kept everything dry around it. See, in a barn, a pole barn is a common thing, but the thing is that you got cattle in there or your animals or whatever, and they pee. And then the pee goes down and adds to the whole rot issue. So it's like, as long as you're not peeing on the floors in your house, you're probably going to be okay. All right? Any other questions at this point? We've got lots more to do. Moving on to the next slide. And the next slide. And the next slide. And the next slide. Hey, how's that look? Does that look okay? Can you live in... Is this acceptable? Would you live in a place... Who would not live in a place like this? Raise your hand, wave it around high. All right. This is not a wafadi. This is a structure that a guy built in England for about... I think it works... You know, when you do the math between pounds and dollars, I think it works at about $6,500. But, you know, you can see that he used a lot of wood right off of his land, and he's got the soil from the roof coming all the way down in the ground, and he's got a lot of the same things. There's only a few variations to get this to be a wafadi, but it's a very beautiful structure. I've got links to it on the website, so you can go see the guy's site, and he tells a story about having built this and stuff like that. But it's a piece of art, both on the inside and, I believe, on the outside. Next slide, please. This is out of Ehler's book. I'm using it with permission, and this is a drawing of his. And this is basically very, very close to a wafadi design. So here you have the... and here you can kind of see an image of it. But you can kind of see the gable roof part in the front, and then in the back you can kind of see where he's made this into a greenhouse of sorts. So you have those ditches in the back that wrap around the house to let the water go around and out and down. Those are underneath glass. So he's got kind of an uphill greenhouse going on. And then he's got the gabled roofing out in the front. And then here he's got like a little extra side window and stuff like that. And you can kind of see this basic structure here. This is a three-bedroom house. So the uphill greenhouse, the main living area. Here's where there'd be glass going to the downhill side. And then, of course, this is all open glass to the uphill side. And he's got windows on the side. So he's got light coming from all four directions. So, I know some people probably look at this and they can't make heads or tails out of what this drawing is, but let's go on to the next slide. For 20 years, I did not read Mike's book because it contained a word that I abhorred. And I was like, I am not ever building one of those. And so, but I kept reading all these other eco-building books that all kept talking about what Mike did here and Mike did there. And it's all like, Mike's brilliant, Mike's awesome. He's really cut some new paths and done amazing things. And that word is, go ahead and hit the underground. So Mike's book is called The $50 and Up Underground House Book. And because of the word underground, I didn't read it. I don't want to live in an underground house. I mean, I've seen them. I've heard about them being abandoned. I don't want anything to do with them. So then in Mike's book, the first thing he does is he says, okay, here's how most people do an underground house, and this is why it's stupid. And then he's got his own design, which is the uphill-facing design. But he can bring light in from all four directions, and he talks about how, you know, he can cut the cost down like by even a factor of 10 from a conventional building of the same size. So, plus the other thing is now when you say underground house, then everybody gets the same negative connotations that I got then. So I've talked to Mike about this, and he says, you know, afterwards, like more recently, I've been thinking that I should have named the book Earth Integrated House. I mean, that sounds pretty permaculture, doesn't it? You're going to live in an Earth-integrated house. And when you look at these things, I mean, they are very Earth-integrated. When you look at them from the outside, it looks like just more soil. It doesn't look like a house. It doesn't look like what we're used to calling a house. It just looks like that hillside just keeps going up. You know, there was those guys, those inspector guys, that couldn't find the house. I was interviewed on a podcast some time ago, and the guy was just wild about these designs because it's like they're all these preppers, these survivalist types, and the idea that they could have a house that people is like basically invisible. Ooh, they really grooved on that idea. So anyway, you go up and it's like I went up to go video Mike Ayler standing in front of his house where, you know, it was so invisible. But the video kind of was crap because it looks like he's just standing on a hillside. And now he's not standing on a hillside. And it's kind of like it made for lame video. All right. I wanted to come up with my own word to describe not only that I wanted something that was strictly for a house, for a home, strictly above ground. I also wanted it to have light from both the downhill side and the uphill side. And I had all these variations, and I didn't want anybody to ever call it an underground structure because this is definitely an above ground structure with a very thick earthen roof. And so it's like I don't want to fall into the same pitfall that Mike fell into. So I needed a new word. So I spent like 3 months trying to come up with a new word. And so this is what I came up with. Go ahead and hit the... I'm going to put that off for a minute. But I'm going to talk about, there's Native American structures that are very similar, and including up in the First Peoples up in Canada. They had something called a Quigley up in British Columbia. I have had, just in the last 4 months, I've had six people send me six different things on Native American structures from way back where they are very similar to a Wafati. And it's amazing how similar they are and what they gain from. I mean, basically the teepee came about to be like the RV version of their original structures. They wanted their communities became so large that being in one place all the time wasn't working out. So they needed to be able to move around. They came up with the teepee to be able to move around. And they just never went back to the old structures, which were effectively a lot like a Wafati. Some of the Navajo Hogans had an earthen roof over a wood frame, which is basically kind of a lot of what we're talking about. All of these different tribes had an earth lodge featuring an earthen roof on straw over a wooden frame. Somebody recently sent me something like just a few weeks ago about birch bark. There were a lot of these structures that were built where they would put the logs up and they would put birch bark over it. And I think the birch bark had to be a very exact age, but they could, if they made a strip down the tree and then cut around it, then they could like peel off big sheets of birch bark, and that's what they would use. Let's see, the British Columbia tribe had homes that were a wood frame with an earthen roof called a Quigley or a Kukuli. Next slide, please. From all the words on my list of words, I put them in priority order, and there it was. Next slide. Wafati. So the W, if we've got to pop through these, the W is going to be for woodland. Next, so go ahead and hit the next slide. The O is going to be a tip of the hat to Mike Ayler. The F is for freaky cheap. And the ATI is going to be annualized thermal inertia. I made the word up. I can have it mean whatever I want. Next slide, please. This is probably the most important thing for the design of this structure. A raindrop landing on the roof never finds a roof edge. This is the big leap that most people struggle with in trying to understand how this roof system works so that you can save so much money. I mean, you know, right now, any kind of conventional roof, I mean, it's probably one of the best conventional roofs that as permaculture folks that we look at is probably like a type of steel. We saw a presentation the other day, whenever it was, where the guy was talking about a certain kind of something on the steel, but it's still steel. We saw the guy just a little while ago giving a presentation about a kind of eco building that he built. He just got through bashing steel and all the yuckiness that came with steel. And what kind of roof did he have on that eco house? Steel. So, but this is going to be something where it's like, we don't even need that steel. That steel is too expensive even for us. Just a few sheets of black plastic and we're set. And that black plastic will last, if it stays away from light, it will last for 500 years. And it's cheap. And it won't off-gas as long as there's no light on it. And I mean, if you think about all your concerns about all the different kinds of materials that might possibly off-gas in all of your home, then this is like a drop in the bucket. This is hardly anything. In fact, you can build a home just by stuff, by materials, by bringing materials onto the land that fill one car. Question. You had a question? You were hanging. No, you did. You had a question.
Yeah, could you substitute that plastic with feeder bark?
Can you replace the plastic with cedar bark? I've had a lot of discussion with Mike and some other people about different kinds of materials. And there is a material that I'm going to add to this plastic. I mean, Mike now uses EPDM, pond liner. And a lot of the people that are currently building Ehlers structures are using pond liner. I mean, yes, I think that there are other things you could use. I'm not sure cedar bark would be a good one. The thing that I advocate is the layer of plastic, and as we'll see in a little bit, newspapers. So, and a lot of this comes from a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I go out and I'm going to do lasagna gardening. I'm going to lay down layers of newspaper, and I'm going to put, you know, wood mulch on it and compost, and I'm going to, you know, have this, I'm going to fight all the weeds and stuff like that. And I'm totally against doing that. One of the reasons is like I went out to this this woman's house, and she's got this apple tree that's doing poorly, and all the rest of the stuff in her garden is doing awesome. This is in the Seattle area. They get lots of rain, and it's like this tree looks like it's not a low leaf count. It looks miserable. So I said, well, you know what? Something's wrong with all the roots. And so let's get a shovel. Let's dig in there and see what there is. And it's like you just shove the shovel in, and first thing, we got like this deep into the soil, and there's something there. We start brushing away the soil. There's newspaper. Oh, yeah! I read somewhere that to beat the weeds, what you do is you lay down newspaper, and it'll totally smother them. Well, it worked. That was 5 years ago. You could still read the headlines on the newspaper. You could read the fine print. You could read the articles. And this is in the Seattle area. It's soggy there. So, and there was like soil sitting on top of it, and I could still read it. And so, yeah, basically what happens is that, I mean, you can try this experiment at home. Lay out a bunch of newspapers, pour water on it. What does it do? It runs off. When people are outside in bad weather and they got a newspaper, they throw it over their heads like a little cheap umbrella. And what happens? It actually kind of works. So now, this gal had it about a half an inch thick. It lasted 5 years, and it was very close to the surface where there's like a lot of aerobic activity, and it did not break it down. Now, granted, you know, I could rig it up so it would break down, and I'm sure a lot of you could do things so it definitely would break down like in 4 or 5 months. No problem. Be gone. You wouldn't be able to read it anymore. But let's talk about embracing what we've discovered here. Let's talk about how do we use that to help repel water from our home for, you know, free. Now, granted, I like the idea of being able to use materials out in the wild, and that's where that birch bark thing comes from. And there's probably other materials, too, that could be used. Another question.
Wax impregnated cardboard.
True. I mean, you've traded one petroleum yucky for another petroleum yucky. And you're right. But I also think for a house size, for house scale, that would be a lot of cardboard. And now you're like, fire up that truck, bring materials in. So whereas, you know, the black plastic, the Visqueen, that stuff's going to be like, that rolls up and fits into your car. You'll have like 3 or 4 rolls in the back of your car. It's like not much material. So, but yeah. You could do. I think cardboard. I think it would be tricky. You'd have to kind of do it like in like several layers, 3 or 4 layers, and it's going to compress, and things things are going to settle, and hopefully that'll work out to be okay. All right. Any other questions at this point? I've got more stuff. All right. Next slide. Okay, we got the house with a gable roof on the downhill slope, lots of glass, a Wafati cooler, which is like a root cellar, but it'll actually be colder than a root cellar. Root cellars are designed to be at 55 degrees. We can take that down to 40. No problem. That, how about a Wafati freezer? Let's take that down to 10 degrees. So we've got designs for that. I mean, basically, it's just the same thing, but working in reverse. We've got some ideas on how to optimize this kind of thing. And then, of course, Wafati Animal Shelter. Sepp Holzer does this kind of thing all the time. If you have a shelter like this, in fact, it's amazing that without knowing each other, Mike Ayler and Sepp Holzer basically invented almost identical structures. They have the same properties to them. And then what Ayler does is that he makes these animal shelters available. And then in the wintertime, it gets really cold out, the animals go and hang out in these shelters where it's like 40 degrees warmer, 50 degrees warmer inside the shelter than outside in the cold. And now they don't need as much feed. They're comfortable with far less feed. And part of the winter is you're trying to get by with a lot less feed. Next slide, please. All right, so here's what the layers look like on the roof, because I think the roof is the most critical component here, because that roof is not only acting as your roof, but it's kind of like acting as one of your big walls. So, of course, on the very top layer, we're going to have the wet soil, and we're going to have like maybe even a couple of feet of it. So when Ayler first designed his structures, it was 3 feet of soil. When Sepp Holzer designed his structures, it was a meter of soil. So here we've got a layer of poly and newspaper, which is going to then, you know, separate your wet soil and keep all the wetitude away from your structure. You're then going to have wood duff, and you can use any other kind of insulative thing you want, but I think wood duff is a great one, and some people are kind of like, well, wait a minute, you know, isn't that going to compact? Yeah, so. Isn't that going to rot? I don't think so. Why would it rot?
Sawdust
would be a type of wood duff. You can use twigs, you can use needles, you can use, I mean, if you want to chip it, you can. But if you don't want to, that's fine too. Air spaces are the thing we really want in there. But of course, this is going to be heavy. This is probably going to make a lot of those bigger air spaces turn into smaller air spaces. So you'll put your wood duff in here. Will critters move in there? No, because it's going to end up being buried. There's no way for the critters to get in there. Will it rot? Well, you're going to need water to get it to rot, and this is going to be dry. So then we have a layer of dry soil. It's going to add to our thermal inertia. But soil itself is also insulative. The wood duff here is going to be dominantly insulative. Another layer of poly and newspaper. And then we get to our structural wood. Next slide, please. This is a Sepp Holzer root cellar and animal shelter. In this case, he used a lot of stones, and then he uses logs on the roof. Log, 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 and then it goes downhill. So the water runs away from the opening here. But there's no uphill opening. Right. So anyway, the key is like this is kind of like the uphill opening here, kind of sort of, but this is actually the downhill. But he's shaped it so that all the water that lands on it is going to run back. In fact, behind there it goes just down into another hillside. This is kind of built on a little bit of a peak, but this is his general design. And then he's got a pipe. In fact, if we go to the next slide, I think we can kind of see into the back of it, and you can see that there's a pipe here. It goes down underneath, and this is gravel, goes down underneath all the gravel and goes like 20 feet out, and then there's an opening. And the idea is that air can come in there and go up there, and this makes it into a root cellar, so you can use this as a root cellar. And then here's a vent that goes out the top, and he's got like a big rubber EPDM thing on the top up there for that. Next slide, please. He uses felt, EPDM, and felt to go on top of a big collection of logs, and then he dumps a meter of soil on top of that. Next slide, please. So here's one that's got some age on it, and he would build one of these in a day. Of course, he already had the wood sitting there, and he had a big honking traco, but still, building something like this in a day. He built one of these. He's been all over the world doing all kinds of stuff. And he built one of these in the deserts of Spain where it gets to like 130 degrees on hot days. And it was for the cattle. And so the cattle would go and hang in there. So he sets it all up, gets it all going. The cattle are loving it and everything. And then he goes away and does other projects. And he comes back to see how things are going. And a bunch of people have moved in and kicked the cattle out. No, you're screwing up the project. I'm not leaving, man. This works for me, okay? So, yes, sir.
That pipe you had in the first slide that ran out, you said, for air to come in.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to keep animals or something like that in there for moisture from the animals, could you also do like a French drain coming out, you think, to keep that away from the wood?
Could you do a French drain on, like, with that structure we were looking at earlier? Or it would probably, the question could probably even apply in here. Could you put a French drain in there to keep the liquids from coming in contact with the wood? French drain is like a, it's a complicated thing. I mean, you know, the design of a French drain is with the idea that when the water level rises and gets to the French drain, then it won't rise any higher. So then all the water, so it's like totally cool with the idea of like so much water coming from above and it soaks all of that. That's totally okay. French drain's like, that's fine. I like soggy soil. Soggy soil is awesome. What I don't like is totally saturated water to come up from underneath, and then I'm going to take that out of here. So I think there's going to be other things to do. It's like you might go and design something like where you compact the soil a certain way down deep so that anything that comes in here will like have an out path that's also away from the wood. I think that would be a smarter thing. I think a lot of people don't fully appreciate the value of a ditch. You know, it's like their first thought is, French drain, man! Water in the soil! But a French drain is really not designed for a lot of the stuff where French drain is used. And sometimes it's like they want to force the French drain to work, and they do all kinds of crazy, wacky things to force the French drain to do what they want. And it ends up being like, okay, we fixed it, finally! And we used French drains. It cost us $100,000, but we fixed it! And it's like, then they find out the next year, like, well, still isn't quite fixed. They went from suck to suck light. So, all right. Any questions at this point? Any other questions? Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Oh, you have another one.
Does Seth give dimensions for the lumber to be able to hold for the static load of 1 meter of soil on top?
Does Seth give dimensions for this wood? Yes, he does. I believe each of these pieces, I mean, I think there's a standard size that I remember doing the math, and I think it's 4 meters. Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure each of these pieces of wood is like 4 meters long. As far as thickness, I've looked at these several times, and I would imagine that they're all like a foot or just shy of a foot, somewhere around in there. Although, you know, he would do it all metric, you know, 0.2 meters or something, I don't know. So, I'm going to show some pictures of what this interaction up here looks like in a moment, which is, I think, you know, the trickiest part to understand. I mean, basically, you kind of see, he just took a whole bunch of these poles and just shoved them into the ground with that traco all the way around. He made a box, and then he laid logs on top of that, and then he did his felt, an EPDM and felt thing, and then threw soil on it. That was pretty much all it was. But you got to put it in such a way that, like, you can kind of see, this is not a hill going this way. This is definitely like a hill going that way. And that's the important difference between the don't do this design and Ehlers design and Holzer's design. Next slide, please. All right, so here's what we were looking at. Here's Holzer's design. And you can kind of see that he's got this log sits on top of, you know, a bunch of rocks, and then these logs sit on top of it. And every third or fourth log or so, he carves off with a chainsaw a flat spot. So that log won't want to roll. It won't get any ideas about rolling. And then everything wants to, like, ooh, off there. So then you can see how you got your ventilation going to the outside from underneath and your ventilation going up through here. He's got a special thing going on right here to get a good seal there. Ehlers says never, ever do anything with your seal. Getting what do they call the thing when they poke a hole in the ceiling and let sunlight in? Skylight. Skylight. Never. Never. Apparently, Ehler gets people asking him that all the time. Never. You won't need it. You won't want it. When you're in an Ehler structure that's got so much light, you don't need to have a skylight. But anyway, here, Sepp Holzer does do this. He makes a little hole, and then he pushes a big pipe through the little rubbery hole, and it does make a pretty good seal. But Ehler would have a total conniption fit over that. So for 12 and a half days, I was with Sepp Holzer going over all kinds of different things, including looking at this structure and talking about the structure. And I drew something out for him, but it's like every time I'd ask him a question or present to him an idea that might be an enhancement of something, then either it seems like it always ended in one of two scenarios. Either he already thought of it, so therefore it is a brilliant idea. Or catastrophe! So go ahead and go to the next slide. I thought this was a good idea. No hole here. Kind of helps to, you know, move the air out, and you had several intakes, and then here with the air coming up, several, so you get a more thorough air exchange. Apparently, this is a catastrophe. I never quite understood why, but apparently it is. All right, next slide, please. Okay, so here we have how the Ehler roof works. And so you're going to have, one set of logs that are going to be basically defining the general shape, another set of logs which are going to be able to hold up a layer of 2x wood, which is going to keep all that soil outside your house. That's where you want it. And then you're going to have, originally his design was they put down a layer of tar paper and then a layer of the visqueen, the black plastic, polyethylene. So, and then you put down 3 feet of soil. Now, he had another design where it's like you put down a few inches of the soil, and then you put down another layer of the black plastic, and then you put down a much more soil. I believe that's how the $50 house was set up. It works. Obviously, it works. And he was able to get all this 2x stuff from a local mill that was, like, selling off these 2-foot-long chunks of 2x for, like, nothing. And so he just got truckloads of it. So he was bringing material onto his land. Go ahead and go to the next slide. This is going to be the Sepp Holzer style. So he just lines all the logs up, throws a layer of felt, layer of EPDM, layer of felt, and piles on the soil. So another success. I mean, Holzer's probably built 50 or 60 of these, and I'll bet you that from people that are following his lead, there's probably thousands of these built. And they're awesome. All right, next one, we're going to see the Wafati. So basically what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to use the wood that's on the land. We're talking about a woodland. We have lots of land. And so I've got the big wood, I've got smaller wood in between, and then I'm putting down layers and layers of newspaper, and then I've got the polyethylene, the black plastic stuff, another layer of newspaper, and then our first layer of soil. Question?
When you were talking about that a second ago, my Ehler design for steps is that steps would require a lot more, it would bear a lot more weight because you're having a lot more log, big, thick logs on the roof, whereas Ehler didn't have the wood, as strong wood. Am I hearing you correctly?
I think that the Ehler's just got his wood arranged differently. I think Ehler's stuff will stand, and it will work.
Yeah.
It's just that it's a different design. It's a different way of going about it. I think Ehler probably does have less overall wood, but he's also crisscrossing it more. So he's got added strength and structure, based upon the way he's going about it. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions at this point?
You've got your layer of newspaper, and you put your soil on top of your newspaper.
That's right. Now we're talking about, when we say soil, we probably mean dirt. I mean, if we've got any topsoil here that's like awesome topsoil, we're probably going to scrape that off and set that aside because that's delicious and yummy and awesome and it's for our growies. Then we're going to get down to the subsoil as we're digging, and there's going to be tons of subsoil. There's gobs of subsoil. Gobs of the stuff that really has no organic matter in it. And then we're going to take that and we're going to start piling that up. And first we're going to do like 8 inches or so. Then we're going to do another layer of newspaper, another layer of plastic, another layer of newspaper. Then we're going to put on 2 feet or so of I left out the duck, but no big deal. So we'll be there too later, of soil, of the subsoil, and maybe, you know, some topsoil. So yes, it's subsoil, which is soil, which is dirt, and it should be relatively free of organisms, so, you know, we're going to reduce our rot factor. And even if it does rot, it's like, so? I mean, a lot of this is going to be designed in such a way that a lot of the water that's going to hit there is probably going to go downhill long before it ever gets to the newspaper layer. So, next question? Any questions? No? Ready to go on? And we're moving on. Next slide, please. All right, now we're talking about hate stuff. So this is out of John Hates. He's got this article up on the Internet. So this picture is on the Internet. I think if you Google for passive annual heat storage, or PAHS, you will find this image. And he's got a couple of – I mean, first of all, he's got the thing where he's doing the 20-foot extension around the house. And he's got, you know, southern openings so he can get, you know, solar heat, solar passive heat coming in and that kind of thing. But really, this could be – I mean, while it's always good to think of the passive solar heat thing, I think everybody in this room probably has memorized that from ages ago. I mean, that one is a pretty simple thing. Basically, when sun comes in your house in the wintertime, it warms your house. Yay! Okay, moving right along. We can design all these to have some of that. And you can take it to an extreme and have lots more. Some people have even taken it to such an extreme that if they have freezing cold temperatures outside and 5 sunny days in a row, they're miserably hot inside. They have to open a window. All right. So he designs the umbrella. Now, he uses first a layer of plastic around a cement structure. But his price, the price of his structures ends up being about the same as conventional homes. But he just doesn't have to heat them. So he has this cement structure. He puts a layer of plastic over that. Then he layers on all that subsoil. And then he does layers of the plastic and conventional insulation and plastic and conventional insulation and plastic. And then that creates this umbrella around the structure, which is going to be your thermal inertia. Next slide, please. Here's a design that he did someplace. I don't know, does it say on there? I think it does. Missoula, Montana. All right. So he kind of outlines where the umbrella goes out, but he's also got these things too, which is like these heat tubes that he does. And so he's got like a tube going through the middle of the thermal inertia to help adjust temperatures inside occasionally. Next slide, please. Dude, annualized geosolar. So this is a guy that is somewhere in the Spokane area. He's got, if you Google annualized geosolar, you come up with stuff. His name is Don something. Don Stevens. His stuff is really rather brilliant. He kind of doesn't like the calling it an umbrella, and which is apparently the Japanese, when they do this, they refer to it as an umbrella. But he's got some stuff where he'll do a steel roof, and then, of course, under your steel roof, it gets like 140 degrees in the summertime. And so what he does is that he'll have a tubes going under your house to where it's kept nice and dry, and there'll be some umbrella-y things, although he won't call it that. And basically what happens is that if you take all that heat from under your roof and through a series of fans, pump it under there, then it heats up that big mass under your house. Now, then you get to the wintertime, a lot of that heat from under there is going to kind of start to find its way into your house. But if it ever gets to be a really cold day and you're like, oh, wow, I want it to be even warmer still, well, you can turn on that fan thing. It'll suck some of that heat out from under there and into your house. Yay! So he's had great success. I saw a presentation that he gave with some other guy, and they were building houses for like $5,000 and stuff. It was really awesome. And the guy's got mountains of knowledge, and I wish he was here today, and I would want to go to all of his presentations. He was doing amazing things, finding all these, like we were trying to think about, like, okay, I want to have an insulative layer in my attic. I want it to be like organic-ish or something like that, something natural, something that's not covered in chemicals, something that won't catch on fire and will pass code and stuff like that. Rice holes. I learned from, I mean, probably half the people in the room are like, oh, yeah, that's rice holes. Duh, everybody knows that. Well, I didn't know that, I don't know, what was that, 8 years ago when I saw him present, and I was like, ooh, I hadn't thought of that. Of course, now you're like still trucking something from 1,000 miles away or more. But still, good to know, a lot of really awesome to know stuff. And he was doing a lot of pulling materials out of the waste stream and getting it to work for him. Oh, yeah, I covered everything on the slide. Good, next slide, please. Oh, here's a feeble attempt at a friend of mine and I spent like 2 days messing around with SketchUp, and we kind of got, this is like the smallest possible Wafati design. And so you can kind of get an idea of, here's the gable roof that goes to the downhill side. Here's the uphill facing stuff where it's going to be dominantly glass. And then, of course, you're going to have thermal inertia umbrellas coming out to the sides this way and that way, and probably a little bit to the downhill and a little bit to the uphill. You have a question, sir? Rice as a possible insulation. It's a waste stream material. And so I know very little about it, but I like the idea that it's like, you know, grow your own insulation. And then you eat part of it, and then you put the rest in your walls. I don't know, sounds awesome to me. Do you like rice? All right, I think the next slide is going to be another picture of this, but a different angle. So, yeah, here you can kind of see the gable roof to the downhill side, and then that's the uphill side. I think I put a guy in there. You can see the guy. It's like the SketchUp guy. Yes, sir?
Is this figure on your roof?
Yeah, well, we've got a big thread where we talk about it. So, and it was in there, but it's like one of those things where it's like, oh, yeah, I should put that in my article. and actually, here's the kicker, is that after spending 2 days screwing around this SketchUp, it's like, we did this the wrong way. So we started a whole new SketchUp. We had a much better way of doing it. And I did that like a year ago, and I haven't put it up anywhere. And then we're like talking about it, and now we need to do a third version where it's even better. We just haven't gotten around to it. So, in fact, somebody said, if you send me the SketchUps, I'll take it into professional awesomeness and share it with the world and you, and you can even own it. And it was like this really generous offer, and I never got around to even finding the old SketchUp file to send to him. But I get like, I don't know, 500 emails a day. So I'm trying to do too many things at once, I guess. All right. Any questions about this structure? No? Next slide, please. There's the guy. See the guy? All right, so this is a very small, and this is each one of these is a 10 by 10 grid, so this is going to be 400 square feet. This is a 400 square. Now, I've got like 9 videos on YouTube right now that feature structures that I believe are under 200 square feet, where people are perfectly comfortable living in a very small space. And this is basically what Art Ludwig advocates. But you can do these in very massive scales, but I think a lot of people that are first time considering these, let's get our heads wrapped around the small thing first, and then you can scale it up if you want. Now, Ehler's got DVDs that explain in detail a lot of the stuff on how he builds Ehler structures to be very large scale, how to get light coming from all four angles and stuff like that. And basically the only thing I'm adding on there is some stuff about what to do with the roof, and then also some stuff about the annualized thermal inertia, how to build an umbrella as part of the structure. So I recommend getting Ehler's book, and also probably getting his DVDs. Next slide, please. Oh, we could watch some Ehler videos. This might be an adventure to see if it'll work. We tried, so Mike was trying to get it to work, and it was like kind of weird. Here's our mousy thing here. So let's do this. That's me and Sepp Holzer hanging out with one of his little structures there. Perfect timing. All right, let's see. We want to go to this. Please wait while your font cache is rebuilt. This should take less than a few minutes. I'm sure that's what you all came to see, is Microsoft at work.
Along the side of the gable coming out, would that be in line with the roof built in the soil? Is that along the side of the gable?
All right, what is your question again?
You have the gable coming out on the downhill side, and then
right.
The two sections next to it, would those be graded with soil?
Yes, but kind of, sort of, a little bit. I mean, you're going to try and want to build your soils. The thicker you make it there, the more thermal inertia you're going to have. And then plus, you know, that's a spot where you can get it really thick, and then you can have more vegetation there. You can have happier soil, happier, bushier stuff. And the bushier, wilder you make it, then the less grief you might get from your local government officials.
You mean that pile of bushes over there? That's a pile of bushes. That ain't no house. That is not an eight-bedroom house. That's bushes. Don't you know the difference between bushes and an eight-bedroom house? What kind of inspector are you?
All right. So there's kind of like a copy of the book. Let's see. Oh, it's kind of working. Oh, what the hell's that? I don't know. But then here's, is it playing? Is it going? I can't tell. Oh, there, it's kind of moving around. So if we've spent an hour and a half screwing around the sound, we might be able to get a sound out of it. But the key is that you kind of get to have a look around the house. And yes, I know that this is a shaky cam. And all my videos feature shaky cam. So if you like this, you know, look at all my videos. And the sound on it is really horrible. I got a new camera since this. But you can kind of see the wood up above that holds this structure and makes it solid. Now, when we took this video, I believe at the time we took this video, no one had lived in this house for 3 years. Have you ever been in a house that no one's lived in for several years? So some nods and some shakes. So it's kind of like, and what did it smell like? Smell like piss? And it's like, so there's mildews that come in, and it's cold, and you get a lot of moisture in there, and it's, so I was kind of, because this is my primary concern, I was kind of hoping somebody would ask this question, and nobody did. When I first started thinking about this, I thought, the problem is that when it gets to be summertime, the walls are going to be cool. You have all these cold walls, and this humid, hot air comes in, and then I would imagine that water would condense on the walls, and you would end up with a house that always stinks like a basement. So, and it's like, therefore, I'm never going to do this. I walked into this. No one's lived here for 3 years. It did not smell. It did not smell of anything. I mean, normally you walk into a house and it smells like that basement musty smell. It doesn't smell musty at all. And that, to me, was a very important discovery in this whole path. When we're there, this place, the solar panel stuff or whatever was all offline that used to give light to it. So there's no electricity there at all. All of this video is with only the light that comes in on the uphill side, which happens in this case to be the north side, the darkest side. And this is in April, a sunny day in April, but this is in a thick, thick forest. So loaded with conifers. And it's like, so you can kind of get an idea of how light it is in there. It's plenty light. But now, how this differs from a Wafati is that it doesn't have the downhill gable roof, which would let in probably, it would probably double the light that comes in there. And in fact, part of the thing he says in here is something about that and how he would do that. We've got 10 minutes left. I don't think there's any more slides in the thing. And, I mean, we could, like, listen to Mike talk about it, tell his bear story. One day I opened up his window, and it didn't quite open up, and then turns out there's a bear there. And, you know. So, anyway, but he actually has light coming in from three different places on here. So the uphill side and the sides. And we could kind of, you know, the video doesn't really show up particularly well. Mostly when I was there, this is years ago, taking this video, I was kind of thinking what I mostly wanted to show is that the structure's still standing and the main structural integrity of the insides of it. And this place could use, I'm trying to avoid using the phrase, a woman's touch. How about a clean person's touch? But, I mean, he kept it fairly clean when I was there. But you could kind of tell it didn't exactly feel like home. It felt like some old hippie's shack. And I would like to go and visit a place. Like, I know that some of the, there's a lot of other Ehlers structures out there where they do look awesome. I've seen pictures of them. They look like a log cabin on the inside. But I just haven't gotten the time to go out and video them. Or maybe you guys could do that. Hey, pop out and get a video of some of these Ehlers structures. Yeah, that'd be cool. All right, questions? Comments? Nothing? We're good? No. Oh.
Have you dealt with any areas that like have a lot of mold or holes
and those getting in through the liners and stuff like that?
Mike has a story. I don't think he tells it in this video, but it was during that trip where he told me that he had a mole come in. Now, of course, his email address is mole@something or another. So he's like a big fan of moles. But he showed me where it was, where he never quite came back to fix it. He kind of just like, oh, whatever. But a mole had dug a path under his carpet and got in to where he has kind of like a root cellar underneath these stairs. I'm not sure. But it's underneath there somewhere. He's got like a root cellar kind of thing set up. And so a mole had burrowed into the root cellar and helped himself. But he burrowed like kind of just under the carpet. So there's this like this little swale right there in his house, right across the carpet. And he left it there. He just thought it was cool to check it out. You know what that's from? So he's had some problems in that space. Now, I think that if you add the umbrella for the thermal inertia, you'll probably reduce the occurrence of that probably by a factor of 100 or so. And considering that 37 years he's had one mole, I kind of think it probably isn't going to be too big of a deal. I mean, when he has one mole, he's like celebrating it. So it's kind of like, yeah, I think it's something certainly to be concerned about, but I think it's going to be mitigated, I think. I would think that if they came through the root layer, then of course they're going to hit the newspaper, and they're going to hit the plastic. But it's like, what are they going to? I mean, first of all, how deep do they really go? And I mean, if you got a 2 foot, I mean, if you were talking about your roof layer was only 4 inches thick, okay, you better be concerned. But if we're talking about it's 2 feet thick, I think that moles only go like a foot, maybe a foot and a half deep, but I'm not sure. And then there's a certain kind of material that they're used to digging. What happens when they hit the newspaper? I would think that they'd be like, what the hell is this? I don't know. It doesn't seem like it would be as easy to deal with as the other soil. Plus, you know, I guess it depends on what kind of soil is there in that top 2 feet. Big gobs of it depends. This one is just the two layers of the polyethylene and soil, no newspapers. And there is the tar paper. But, I mean, this is like version 1.0, and 37 years is still standing. So I haven't heard from other people having a lot of problems with moles, but I do think that it would be something to be concerned about, you know, if you hadn't done a version 1.0 yet. But now that we've kind of crossed that path, it seems like it hasn't been showing up as a problem. Yes, sir.
I just need a little bit more better understanding of the thermal inertia. So I think you mentioned also that from that first layer of plastic that you put down, newspaper, the more soil that you put between that and the second layer of plastic, the better the thermal inertia. Is that correct?
That's going to add insulation and thermal inertia. But on the other hand, it's like you want to have some thickness up there for your plants. And if you got it to be 10 feet thick, I mean, is your wood structure inside going to be able to handle that load? And Mike's book goes into a lot of detail about what wood will handle what load when set up what way. And so load's going to be a big part of it. And granted, you could even say, oh, I want to make it thinner so that way I don't have to have as fat a wood. And it's kind of like, I think that that's not a good idea either. So, yes. However, I think it's better. I mean, you're going to get enough thermal inertia, enough thermal inertia from the top, as well as enough insulation from the top with this current design. And while it's a worthwhile conversation to talk about, now let's start monkeying with the numbers. I think that what you're going to gain isn't going to really be enough. What your real thermal inertia is going to be at your walls and your floor. So the answer is yes, you will get that, but I think I want to talk you out of it.
You said
also that it sounds like
that thermal inertia actually builds and then comes to some sort of equilibrium after maybe the second or third year.
I don't think I would quite put it that way. I think you're going to have your thermal inertia is there from day one. And then the thing is like, you know, where do you want it to end up? And then based upon your comfort choices, you will be naturally kind of setting it to your comfort level. And then as the years pass, you're going to get closer and closer and closer to what it is that you want. But I think that if you build the structure in August, I think your first year is going to be warm. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay. Next question. Yes, sir.
Where is the $50 house? Where is the house?
Where is the $50 house? It's near Bonner's Ferry, Idaho. Do you know where that is? Yeah. Now you know. Next question. Yes, sir.
In the Microsoft Paint illustration of Steph's structure, he had rocks in the back. Was that for thermal also?
I know
Steph does a lot of stuff with rocks and thermal. So.
Oh yeah, Steph loves to play with rocks. That particular image had to do with the fact that, you know, because where I was taking pictures that day, he was doing a rock design one, and he was using the big rocks because the person who owned that piece of property wanted it to be big rocks. Mostly for the aesthetic stuff. But yeah, rocks will last longer than wood, but it's like, I think the first place the wood's going to give is with the roof. That, you know, so I would think that, you know, when that roof starts to go, or when the wood in that roof starts to go, that's the first thing to go. And so I don't think the rocks are adding any longevity really to the structure. Does that answer your question?
No, it's just, does that... Is that a store of heat?
It is a store of heat. I would say that it's not going to be all that different from the soil, from, you know, basically the dirt that's behind the wood. But it is a store of heat, and it is going to be something where it's more of a direct store, like the wood. If you had wood walls in there, they're going to be mostly insulative. But I think it's going to make hardly any difference in that space for that particular structure and the way it's designed. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes, sir.
What's the longevity? I know it's not going to change where you're at. Without rain a lot or different public drive, but what's the average longevity?
What is the average longevity of a Wafati? You mean a structure which has never been built to date? Just lots of people talking about building them and none under construction. An Ehlers structure or a Sepp Holzer structure? Sepp Holzer says 10 years for his. Ehlers suggests a lifespan of 20 plus years. And this is with using coniferous wood. Both of them say, but if you use black locust, you should be able to expect pretty much, you know, more than your lifespan. Black locust is a very hard, very heavy wood with 4% fungicide by weight. So it's like when those rotty myceliums come along and they're like, I want to eat you. Then they go to the black locust and then they say, ow, ow, ow. And then they don't rot it. They don't eat it. So, yeah, last long time. Another question. Yes, sir.
A height house, is it safe to assume that's a good 60, 80-year lifespan for a height house?
Oh, height.
Yeah.
As in hate. Like John Haight. Is he pronounced it height? I've always heard it pronounced hate.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, of course, his structures tend to be all cement. So I imagine the lifespan of those cement structures of built white, right, could be 1,000 years. But, of course, you know, there's that whole thing, too, when we start exploring cement. I mean, you know, we talk about, global warming, we're against it. Who's for global warming? Who thinks it's awesome? Okay, nobody. One guy, he thinks it's the Buddhist monk guy. I'm all for it. This place is like cold. So, but everybody else is against it. Well, whenever you do that cement stuff, I mean, like nothing puts more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than you know, the process they go through for getting us cement. So then it's kind of like, you know, hey, we're going to be eco-cool. We're going to save the world. But first I'm going to fuck up the atmosphere. Hell, wait, that sounds like I'm going to go over good with my buddies. And I like my buddies, so what do I do? So the cement thing definitely will have a lot of longevity. The folks that wrote The Good Life, Nearing and Nearing, they've got a way of making their own cement, And at the same time, I mean, they build everything out of stone, which takes forever. But, oh, hey, I just thought of something. There's an ecostructure that we didn't bash. Does anybody want to bring up ecostructures that they want to have bashed? There's one that everybody seems to like. Earthships, yes! Yes, okay. I like what Jack Spirko says about Earthships. He says, if you want to build an Earthship, first thing you got to do, go get yourself a tire and some dirt and a sledgehammer and pack the tire with dirt. And then keep in mind, you're going to do 3,000 of those to build your house. But just try doing one, and then ask yourself if you really want to build an Earthship. And his position is that after doing that, no one will ever want to build an Earthship. I mean, it's hard work, and it takes a long time. I mean, a lot of those Earthships that are in construction have been under construction for 3 years. But then there's all the concerns about the off-gassing. You know, a lot of the Earthship advocates say there's no off-gassing. And I'm sorry, I go into a tire store to buy new tires, and it's like those, they don't have the sun beaten on them, but man, they stink to high heaven. And the Earthship folks say, well, yeah, but then when they get older, they don't do that. Well, I think they don't do it as much. And then it's like, and I've been out to where they're building Earthships, and it's like, ew-wee, man, it smells like tires. I think those tires are off-gassing. And, oh, well, but those tires are exposed to sun. That's why you smell that. When we get this done, they won't be exposed to something. They won't be off-gassing. So it's like, okay, if you say so. I mean, the people who have gone through, I mean, if you've gone through 3 years of building something and then somebody points out a flaw in what you built, are you going to say, that's a flaw? Or are you going to stab the person that said that so that way no one will ever hear of that again? All right, any other questions? Should we beat up on any other eco-structures? Anybody? Anybody know we're good? Any other questions about any of this stuff? All right. Say bye to the pod, people.
Bye.